No, I think I'll ask the boys. No, that's okay. I'll leave it. Good. So, my apologies for not speaking Norwegian. I'm only... I'm from Holland, and it's a little... Anyway, you speak Danish, so it doesn't count. Norwegian with a Danish accent. It's nice to be here. I'm a sannyasi. A sannyasi is one who has no home and who is basically in this world to give all energy for spiritual life. Because generally speaking in life, some people have no spiritual life at all. What can I say? That's dry. When there's no spiritual life, then we are forgetting part of our real self, a deeper part. And then life, with time, slowly we're running out of strength. One time, I was doing a program, and before me, in the program, there was a Russian clown. And this Russian clown, he was from the Russian state circus, so he was quite expert. And he was spinning around balls on sticks. So at least he had a ball on a stick on his nose, and he had two balls spinning on his toes, and then on two sticks he had balls in his hands, and he was moving them around. So it was good. I mean, it wasn't easy to do. And all that was happening in the temple for the Sunday feast, just like we've gathered now. And I was thinking that he was really good, but what it had to do with the temple, I didn't know. I mean, like, you know, you do that in the church, you think, like, okay, very good, but what does it have to do with what's going on here? So I had to speak after, so I thought, how do I connect this thing with spiritual life? You know, how do I make something out of this? So what I did was, I was thinking, it reminded me of the stream of opportunities. Have you also been there? When you go to the stream of opportunities, when you're young, you take a few, three, four, five, you spin them around like that. And then, but as time moves on, you lose that youthful energy, that unlimited energy. And at one point, you become more purposeful. You pick out the good ones. Got it. The stream of opportunities continues. A good one. Take it. The stream of opportunities keeps on flowing. Got a good one. That one, no. Yes. But time moves along. And then comes the time that one misses a good opportunity and will just say, anyway, it wasn't that good anyway. And in the end, there are two old people sitting on a bench, and one is saying to the other one, that was a good one. So in this way, life is like that, that with time, our capacity to take advantage of all the opportunities of life diminish. That is the name. That is old age, actually. What can you say? You can't eat this anymore. You can't do this anymore. You can't. So many things. That is the nature of material life. But at the same time, in old age, one has a wealth of experience, and with it, depth. Then, if there is some thought of what is on the other side of this life, on the other side of this life, beyond the end, beyond death, what is there? If there is some thought about that, then in old age, all that wisdom from a lifetime becomes deep and rich. And one can see there is a constant factor. Those who understand spirit understand that spirit is eternal. They understand that life doesn't end with this one, but that this is simply part of our journey. Now we are here in this condition. Later we'll be somewhere else. It doesn't end. So in this way, spiritual life begins. Somehow or other, as I began to say, I became a sannyasi. A sannyasi is one who gives all his time and energy just for spiritual life. You know how it is in the world. If you're interested, you have some spiritual life, but you also have a material life. You always have to balance. So much for Krishna, so much for me, so much for Krishna, so much for me. Okay, a little bit more for me. What to do? It's like, it's a balance. How to keep the balance? It is a struggle, not so easy. How much time? Balance my time. How much money? Balance my money. How much spiritual things? How many material things? Balance, balance, balance. Material life is all about balance. That's the key. The key is to find a balance. Isn't it true? Anyone who's a little older, has a few gray hairs, will agree with me, I think, that balance is the art. It's the art of how to get across material life. And they say keeping that balance is not just a matter of finding your place. No. It is like keeping your balance while riding a bicycle. It's balance in motion. So when you ride a bicycle, you have to adjust the balance. So to keep a balance, there is not one position that is balanced. One has to adjust. So life is like that. It's juggling. Juggling different interests. Sometimes one needs a little attention. Another time, another one needs a little attention. Sometimes the spiritual side. Other times the material side. And we balance, and we balance. And in everything, we're looking for balance. But if one is free, if one is free for spiritual life, then that is very wonderful. When I first came to India 40 years ago, which is, you know, then I was impressed by that country. Because in many ways life was more natural than life at home, which I liked, because I didn't like it that one is reported by one's parents within 24 hours after birth, and then it begins. Then you have duties. Then you have to go to school. Then so many things, so many obligations. And it's thinking, somebody has already decided what I have to do with my life. Whereas I have no choices. Even if you don't have a television, you still have to pay the tax for the television. I don't know if it's in Norway, but in most European countries it's like that. You have to pay the tax anyway, because we give you the opportunity to watch the television. So you have to pay the tax. But I never watch television. I haven't watched television for more than 40 years. And still, they want you to pay the tax. Why? I have to pay a tax if I don't even want it. I don't have one. I don't want one. I don't want to watch it. So pay the tax, sir. Why? Because we give you the opportunity to watch it. So Indian culture was very different. It was more simple, more natural in many ways. People, they had more, apparently, they were closer to nature. But not only that it was a more natural society, I guess also the climate was contributing to it. Because Europe, we have such a heavy winter that here artificial means help. It's a lot of work if you have to just live with firewood in Norway. That's a lot of wood. Then in the summer, no vacation. Then in the summer, You have to work very hard to get all the wood and all the food for the winter. And that's how it used to be, obviously. So it's easy if you have a button and the heater goes on. It has its advantages. Therefore, it's not surprising that in a climate like Europe, a more artificial way of life developed. Whereas in India, it's warm. Garam. No problem. Nice and warm. So in this way, life was easy in the East. People were living more simple. In some ways it reminded me of the Middle Ages. When I first came to India, I went to the city of Benares, and all I did was just sitting and watching people. It was like, just watching. It's just the whole day, it's just looking at everything. And it was just, everything was different. Suddenly there was this ox cart coming right through, like straight from the Middle Ages. A wheel which was just like one big piece of wood, no spokes, just one big piece of wood, like a tabletop, round, you know, but just one big flat piece of wood. It reminded me, I'm from Holland, it reminded me of a painting from Bruegel. You know, I saw these medieval paintings, and there I saw these kind of ox carts. I thought, like, my God, they still exist. And the people were going to the temples, and everywhere there were small temples, big temples, bells, and so much worship was going on. And then on the bank of the Ganges, there was ritual going on. I don't know what it was, but priests were sitting there, and people came, and there were colored powers and flames, and people would come in the evening, hundreds of people with little flower boats and a light, and they would just offer it like that to the river, put it in the river, and at night all these little lights would flow away, and then a boat would come past filled with people all singing religious songs. I liked it. I thought that, you know, where I came from, religion was such a thing, you know. It was just, first of all, it seemed, whatever was there, it seemed dry. Churches were empty. No one would go. Many turned into other buildings, right? Some became bars, right? Yeah. That's what happened. The percentage went down. The other day, I was looking at statistics, and I didn't look up Norway, but I saw that in Bolivia, 86% of the population is still going to the church, and in Sweden, only 2%. I don't know what that makes it, makes it for Norway, but I have a suspicion that they're closer to Sweden than to Bolivia. Now, Sweden was at the bottom, I'm sorry to say, for our Swedish guests here today, with 2%. Bolivia, the max. But that says something. In India, everywhere, some worship was going on. Every street corner, every field, there was a temple, and not just some old monument, but people who were worshiping there. At night, the worship was there. So, therefore, in a country like Holland, religion is something very private. No one talks about it. And if somebody brings it up, you go like, oh, you really have to do that? Hey, please, you know? You're not trying to convert me or something, are you? You know, I mean, do me a please, keep it for yourself. You know? If you want to talk about God, do me a favor. Just keep to yourself. I don't know how it is in Norway, but that's sort of the predominant mood where I'm from. It's, you don't speak about it, you know. It's a private thing. In India, it was not. In India, it was everywhere. It was a public thing. There was so much worship. I was in Benares, and the temple was playing 24 hours a day the same mantra. never change the tune at all. Yeah, it's just the same tune, 24 hours a day. And I stayed close to this temple, and it was going like, Siri Ram De Ram De De Ram, Siri Ram De Ram De De Ram, Siri Ram De Ram De De Ram, Siri Ram De Ram De De Ram. Like that. So I liked the Siri, especially, because Banaras is like, the part of India where they speak a very high class Hindi. It is supposed to be Sud Hindi, the best Hindi, and therefore they don't. Everywhere else they say Sri, but in Pakka Banarasi Hindi, Siri. So I liked it. It had a musical ring to it. So later I was back in the West. And I was driving my car on the highway, and I would also go, it kind of, it stuck, you know, like any local top hit. If you hear it long enough, you can't get it out of your head, and it just stuck, and I took the mantra with me. And I must say that I knew it had a spiritual meaning, and I knew it was a temple song, and that's one reason why I liked it. I knew it brings positive energy, and I felt very, I felt good about it, that this mantra was part of my life, and I chanted it every day. I worked it out on guitar and different ways. I sang the mantra, and also sometimes I learned you could quietly speak the mantra. This was not singing was kirtan, but mantra could also be spoken quietly, and then it was known as japa. So in this way, I was also chanting this mantra regularly in japa as a sort of meditation, and it was it brought something into my life. It brought I noticed it was like an anchor. It was anchoring me. You know how life is, you go through so many things, but I had this mantra which I was chanting every day, and it was kind of giving me a spiritual focus. Through it, I maintained that spiritual focus. The mantra stayed with me. It was during that time also that my mother, somehow or other, became very ill and got terminal cancer in the bones, a tumor then, and so at one point she was in the hospital, and it was really, the doctor was saying all the signs were there, she wasn't going to make it beyond 24 hours. And I think, what do I do now? What do you do at a time like that? Am I on TV?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So I was sitting there, and then I thought, yes, I must do something sacred now. You know, now my mother is leaving. What positive thing can I do now? So I thought, well, let me chant that sacred song from India. So I sang it quite loud. And the nurse came and said, "Psh, this is a hospital." I said, "Look, you know, my mother's dying. She said, okay then. So, nurse. So I chanted that at the time of her death. I didn't know, but I just intuitively did so. I felt I wanted to do something sacred, something spiritual, because I felt strongly that there was something after death. And therefore I felt that now she is going into this transition, and I should give her, as she's going in there, the best possible support for her ongoing journey. So I chanted this mantra. Later, as I became more knowledgeable and read the Bhagavad Gita, later when I read the Bhagavad Gita, I found out that this was exactly what you were supposed to do. So I was very satisfied. Phew, I did the right thing for once in my life at the important moment, right? It was the grace of Lord Ram and Lord Krishna who somehow allowed me to chant that name at that particular time. So, with time, my spiritual life was growing, as my interest in spirituality was growing, that little bit, that little spot of spirituality, every day turning to the mantra and so on, and then chanting it for my mother. Then after she left, then I thought, okay, now I really need a break from this whole thing. Both my parents had died quite short after each other. It was intense time, so I thought, okay, let me go for a journey to India. And I went to India again. I've been there so many times. To India again. And it was at that time that I became more serious. I thought that I guess the death of my parents made me more serious and made me think about what am I going to do with my life. And I at one thing my mother said at the very end, right, or in her last hours, she said to me, I told her, I said, now you should pray. She said, I have no faith. No wonder, because the last time she ever went to church was on her marriage day. And afterwards, never again, right? You know how life is, you know, you get so busy. It's hard to keep the balance. It tends to go to one side. Yeah. So, in this way, I was thinking, no, I want to be in a better position. I think I should invest more in spiritual life. So I did. And then I came across this book that's now in front of me, the Bhagavad Gita as it is. The book spoke about reincarnation. Yes, I had already been in contact with that. As a Westerner, when you hear about reincarnation for the first time, you think like, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, reincarnation. It's like, you know, it's an idea. It's a nice idea, and they believe in it in the East. But why? You know, some idea. Why would you just? What's the proof? Nobody remembers that. All these believers in reincarnation, do you remember then who you were before? No. I said, then why do you believe in it? So, as a Westerner, I found it something, okay, you know, I know. There's lots of countries in the East, they believe in reincarnation, but personally, I can't do anything with that. That was my first reaction. But then, I went a little deeper into it, and I began to explore the concept more, and then I heard that the idea behind reincarnation was that at the end of life, one is not finished. Nobody is finished. And then it said, well, I learned something in my travels in India. This is like one day I was in the city of Benares, and there was a beggar lying in the street, and he was dead as anything, and you could see it. And I just never seen anything like that, a dead person lying in the street, because where I'm from, we don't have that. Dead people are not lying in the street, right, in Holland. I don't know if in Norway, but where I'm from, no. And I don't know if somebody dies, they always find a blanket somewhere, but in seconds, the body is... By the time you see a body, it's covered with a blanket, and then there's an ambulance in no time, and that's all you ever see. And unless someone, at a funeral and so on. But this here, a dead body in the street. All right, I recognized the man. He was an old beggar, now dead. People were walking past, and they were all throwing money on the body, coins. And within about 15 minutes, the whole body was covered in coins. So I stood there looking like, what's going on? You know. So I asked someone, I said, what are you doing here? Why is everyone throwing coins on this body? Why? He's died, he was a beggar. Yesterday he didn't have a cent, that's probably why he died. And today you're burying him in money. What are you doing? Yeah? And I was thinking, if you would have given him the money yesterday, maybe he was still alive. Right? A typical Western response. You know. Then they explained. They said, no, you see, they said when someone dies, then the soul goes in the subtle body, out of this gross body, and is hanging over this body, and is trying to go back inside. He can hear everything, can hear people speaking, can see everything, but cannot get back in. Trying again and again to go back in. People say, oh, he's dead, he's gone. No, I'm here. Nobody hears. What a situation. He said that, actually, yes, the departed soul should not try to go back into the body. When it is not possible to re-enter, then that departed soul should just let go of that body. Then he'll go on to his next destination. But it's a little difficult. Because one is fearful and trying to get back. Therefore, in the Vedic culture, it is said that the body had to be burned as soon as possible. That's why the cremation thing. It's because if you cremate the body, then immediately that soul finished. Right? So, but if you bury the body, then sometimes the soul is hanging around for a long time and will not go on to the next destination and will remain around in a subtle body. That there are beings hovering around in subtle bodies is something we will not just believe in daytime, but at midnight when the clock strikes 12, dying, 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 and all the way up to 12. If then suddenly the door goes like, what was that? nothing, just the wind. But there is no wind. What's that? Must be a mouse. That's a mouse with pretty heavy boots. What is that? At midnight, it all sounds a lot more credible that there are subtle entities. Like that. Yes. Anyway, people in the East had this idea that the soul is hovering over the body and cannot go back in, and therefore they were cremating the body. So they had a very distinct faith that this was going on, and I was amazed that all these people believe this. They all throw money on this body. They all believe this. And the person also said, yes, and if the soul then is still attached to this world, then again he will be pulled back into material existence and to express these desires once again. So in this way, reincarnation was explained. That if one still has so many unfulfilled desires, that one comes back to fulfill them again. Then I thought, well, actually, makes sense after all. It's not as strange as the thought it was. So little by little, by being exposed to this culture, the ideas of that Oriental culture came closer to home. And concepts like reincarnation became more possible for me. I don't say that I bought into it, but I'd say, well, it's a possibility. Then karma. Well, karma just made sense, complete sense, because karma, action and reaction. Because it explains why is one person born poor, the other one born rich, one person born in a total antisocial family, where the family kicks him around like a football from his very childhood, and then he grows up and even in his youth gets involved in crime, right? And then the whole life inside jails and outside jails, and at the end of life he goes to hell. Whereas someone else is born as the son of a priest and sings hallelujah from early childhood until the day he dies and he goes to heaven. I thought that's not fair, because even we wouldn't make a judgment like that. Even we human beings would consider the background and say, no, this person didn't have a chance, came from a bad background. How can you send him to hell? You know, he's a victim in a way. We could see like that. So I couldn't buy into that. But then the Eastern way of thinking, that one would take a birth according to karma, a good one or a bad one, made a lot of sense. So by the time I first got a Bhagavad Gita and I start reading it, I was still smoking cigarettes, and I was smoking my cigarettes, puffing away and smudging the pages with ashes, and thinking to myself, yeah, I know this. Now, I think, maybe not quite. Maybe I did not fully understand. Maybe I didn't understand how one must be pure. Like here, I have a verse in front of me from the Bhagavad Gita, which I'll read to you now. Manushyanam sahasresu kaschit yatati siddhaye yatatam apisidanam kaschinmam vetitatvataha. Out of many thousands amongst men, one may endeavor for perfection. And of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. And this verse exactly relates to my first experience with the Bhagavad Gita. Very few people will actually take interest in spiritual life and come to a point where they say, yes, I want to get a little more serious about this. Very few. Very, very few of those who are a little more serious and who actually show some interest in spiritual things, right? Very few of them become serious and start to make a real endeavor for spiritual life. Out of those who become serious and make a real endeavor for spiritual life, very few attain perfection. So just see, those who are interested, those who are trying, and those who attain perfection. Yes. Yes, maybe at that time I was a little bit interested. A little. But I wasn't serious about endeavoring for perfection, because I was still addicted to cigarettes and other things, and, you know, what to do. And I wasn't so sure that I wanted to give up all these things. I liked to philosophize next to the fireplace with a glass of cognac and saying deep philosophical things, you know, have a sip and smoke cigars at the same time. I liked. I thought that was cultural. I didn't know. So what was lacking was purity. If one really wants to go deeper into spiritual life, if one wants to go deeper in spiritual life, then what is needed is purity. That purity is not so easily attained. You know, sometimes I walk on an airport, and you know, and there is the Jew with the little curls, you know, and there is the Muslim with the little hat on, yes, and there is from Spain some Christian monk with a big cross, you know, and an Arab is walking there, like fully decked out in his Middle Eastern outfit and his wife completely covered. And then there is me. Yeah? And you just wonder, what is this? An airport or a religious exhibition or something? You know what I mean? And am I walking in this parade?
The religious fashion.
Right? So, like that, we are walking on this airport, yeah, and seeing that in the world there are so many different religions. Why is it? Why is it? Oh. One time I was in Denmark for our Ratiatra, which is a big public festival, and at the end there was a stage and I was asked to give a lecture on the Rathusplatsen. Yeah? Am I pronouncing it?
Rathusplatsen.
Okay, well that takes a little more practical.
Rathusplatsen.
My God. I need to drink water for that. Anyway, I was there on that place and yeah. And I was I remember that in the talk, the topic that came to my mind was, do 5 million people really think that they are the chosen ones? And think, you know, do 5 million people really think that somehow or other, by God's grace, they were the ones that got the truth, and the rest of the world, too bad, too bad. I asked them, do 5 million people really think like that? That they, you know, happened to be in their church in Denmark, yes, they somehow or other got the mercy of God, they got the truth, the rest of the world doesn't know what they're trying, but unfortunately missed it. It sounds so as I continued like that, the people could understand, no, that's too narrow-minded. Then it must be that there are some people across the border that also know something about the truth. And possibly they have a little different conception. And still, it must be. Why is that? Because for human beings, for us in this world, there is one problem. God is invisible. That's why there are so many religions, because people don't know. So they sort of say, is there a God or not? You can count on your buttons. Is there a God? Is there not? Is there a God? Is there not? And if you still don't know, you can sew on an extra button. Because who can answer the question? Is there not? How do you know? I feel it. Yes? Is that enough? Is everything you feel true? Maybe, maybe not. How do you really, really know? Of course, you can get into different arguments why there is, and I'll save you the debate, is there a God or not. I'll say there is, and that if there is, you'll be a lot, if you accept it, you'll be a lot happier than if not, because every truth has its results. If you're a bunch of chemicals, if I am just a bunch of chemicals, then I need a drink. If that's all I am, a bunch of chemicals, then I need a drink to feel better. Right? But if I am actually eternal, then I feel quite good. Then I don't need a drink. That's why since I believe that I'm eternal, I stopped drinking. Before, when I thought I was only chemicals, I used to drink a lot. Quite a bit. But then I stopped it since I believed that I was eternal. I felt a lot better. Didn't need it anymore. Even the smoke eventually went, although that was the last thing to go, I must admit. So, different beliefs, because we don't know. We don't know what is there. We can't see. We can't see. We can see. Oh, you can see. And the journalist asks our guru, Srila Prabhupada, can you see God? I said, yes, I can see. Oh, you can see. And Prabhupada said, and you can see also. I said, you want to see? The journalist said, yes. Show me. I said, okay, then you must become like him. And he pointed to one of his disciples and so on. journalist said, well, you know, I mean, I've got a family, I've got three children, you know, I've got a lot of responsibilities at home, you know, I mean, I can't do that. Prabhupada said, then don't speak of seeing God. It's not so cheap. If one wants to see, it's possible, but one must be pure. Therefore, out of many thousands among men, one may take interest. But because it's not pure, such a person cannot know. Takes interest, interested in spiritual things, but still not sure, still some doubt. Maybe, yes, I like these things, Swamiji, but I am not sure. How do you know that this is not all my talati? Even in India, people say like this. Yes, because they're not sure. But when we get more serious and we become pure, when we become more pure, then we can see. Then we can see. So seeing God is possible. And at first we'll see the hand of God. At first we can see the hand of God in different things, in different situations. We can see this is more than chance. Come on, this is an arrangement, clearly. At first we see the hand. Then if we get more dedicated and more pure, and we give our life in service, then with time we can see him face to face. That is possible. Then we can see. And in this way, Prabhupada was saying, yes, he was seeing all the time. So therefore, what is required is not only spiritual interest, but if one wants to have a deeper spiritual experience, one must be pure. Previously, in traditional societies, either in the West or in the East, the societies had a program for the spiritual upliftment of people in general. Now, the government doesn't have a program for the spiritual upliftment. Now the government is running casinos and bars and, it's business. Money, money, money. And they give themselves fat salaries and black money paid in Swiss bank accounts. And, you know, as long as you're in office, you're trying to get as much as you can. And that's life. And that's what's going on in the world. Therefore, gradually, people in the world are preoccupied with so many things other than spiritual life. I told you I never watch TV. I just never watch TV. But, of course, how can you be in this world and never see anything? So I do see something, especially on planes when I travel. Nowadays, everyone has his own video screen. And then I see the people sitting there watching. Everyone has his own movie. And, you know, there's violence in these movies. And I'm not used to it, you know. So I see people nicely munching away, you know, like and in front of them somebody is being murdered. And I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, because I'm not used to it. I never watched these things. So I'm totally shocked. And they're just peacefully munching on something, you know, and just moving. Meanwhile, someone is being slaughtered in some way. Horrible. So this is the way it is, right? We're so used to it, to people being killed in front of us on TV, and then you can play computer games and you can just kill them. Bang, 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 bang. Bang! Pew, 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 pew. Kill, 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 pew. Then some demons come in the game. And then at the end, then, you know. And then you're surprised how in real life some guys go around and like. Because the culture is not favorable. The culture is not bringing out the. We're teaching people how to become hard-hearted. Yeah? We're teaching our children. And I look at cartoons sometimes. I see the kids are looking. I come in the house and they've got the cartoon on for the kids. I look at these cartoons and I think, phew, these are not nice people in these cartoons, or nice animals usually. It's like, they're quite cruel. Yeah, it's not just so funny, you know. It's quite heavy many times. But.
So,
if we have a culture to bring up our children in a way that they understand that mercy, kindness, compassion for all living beings is important, that purity is valuable. If we bring up our children in that way, then first of all, you know how it is when you bring up children, or maybe you don't, but when you bring up children, they force you to be an example. Because kids don't do what you say, they do what you do. And that's, so you'll have to be an example, otherwise they're not going to do it. Yeah? And in this way, if you try and teach your children a culture of purity, of honesty, a culture of compassion, a culture of doing something positive in the world, a culture of giving to others instead of a culture of taking, for me, me, for me, then, if for us to give the example, then we'll need strength and support. They want to come in.
I told them to call them. Tell them to come here.
Come. So if we want this, if we want to give this to our children, or if we want to make a peaceful society where craziness cannot happen, where no crazy things can happen anymore, then we'll need to have a society where there's room for spiritual culture. Then we need to actually educate people about spiritual subject matter, about the wisdom of the Gita, and so on. Then little temples like this become more important. And then little temples should become big temples, or many little temples, all over. Because what's one little temple going to do for a big city like Oslo? But such spiritual influence is helpful. So we are not just a bunch of dreamers walking around with flower power left over from, you know, the dreamy 60s or something. When you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear a flower in your hair. I have no hair, not much. This is not some dreamy, impractical thing. People praying all day. What are these people doing? Go get a job? But you're praying all day? Just praying? Yes, we pray and we do other things. We speak about the Gita to become pure so that we can encourage others to also live purely. Yes, why kill for our food? Because it tastes good. It tastes so good. Yeah, but it is not so nice to do that. The killing. So why? What if we could make something tasty and avoid the killing? Maybe better. Maybe better. What if we would have a world where we avoid killing for our food? That would help. That would help. Have you ever been to a slaughterhouse? I have. It's not so nice. If you also have, then you know it's not so nice. It's quite brutal.
So,
in this way, if we want a world filled with peace, it's not so easy. Some years ago, they had these ecological conferences. They had one in Johannesburg, and before that, one in Rio de Janeiro. And the conclusion of the environment conference was that it will not be possible to do anything about the environment. No matter how many measurements we put in place, you know, It will not be possible because people, they are too, they have too much self-interest. So they'll go for the profit. They'll go for the profit and they don't care. So therefore, it will not be possible unless people find a spiritual motivation. That was the conclusion of Rio de Janeiro. Only a spiritual motivation can bring people to the point where they get serious about the environment. Interesting. Then they had an AIDS conference in Manila. And they were discussing AIDS, and they said, we tried different things. The condoms campaign didn't work. That didn't work. Then they said, now the best thing will be abstinence. Just no sex without marriage. So it's like, you know, be real. Come on. You know. I mean, you know, no sex without marriage. Come on, you know, how is it possible? And what about a Saturday night and, you know, and all of that? Come on, what will you do on Saturday night? No, it's not practical. And again, and people said, no, this is not practical. So the only way it could be practical if people would have a spiritual motivation. 2-0 for spiritual life. Just see. Solutions for the environment. Solutions for the AIDS problems in the world. Solutions for peace, right? Solutions against crazy people who just go around doing crazy things. Therefore, it's not impractical. It is very practical, actually. This, Srila Prabhupada went to the to Chicago, to the to a big police chief, and he explained to him that he had a solution for crime. Chicago, Al Capone, you know, mafia capital, everybody knows, you know, Chicago, violent cases, and they don't have violence inside. That's Chicago for you. Yes. But this Krishna consciousness can bring us solutions in our life. And the more serious we become about it, the more we get a genuine spiritual experience. And therefore, it's very nice. Wow. And the more one gets a spiritual experience, the more we become satisfied. And then we don't need so many things, you know. When you're not satisfied, like hungry, like just like eating. You get something to eat, but it wasn't very tasty. So you sort of filled your belly, but you're not satisfied. You still want to eat more. We know this kind of thing, when you don't eat something very nice. You sort of, that is like eating half. Right? And then you're walking around still feeling like, I must have something. It wasn't good enough. Still hungry. Yes. So this is life in the material world. We have everything. Huh? iPhone and this and that and all, we have everything. Still hungry. We live so good. Still hungry. As long as we have no inner fulfillment, still some emptiness. Human being will always feel empty. As long as there is no spiritual fulfillment, we will be hungry. We will be restless. We will not have peace. We will look everywhere. We will not have it. We will just always be roaming around, looking. Is there something more? Third marriage, still hungry. You know? Anyway, I was just unlucky. Maybe this time it will work. I doubt it. We're probably going for the fourth and the fifth and, you know, still hungry. People are still hungry. So without spiritual life, the world will be like that. So it is very nice. And therefore we are happy you came and listened to my talk today. I hope that we have whetted your appetite and think this was good. We want a little more. Is there more of that? And there is a lot. So you are most welcome to explore further into the depth of spiritual life. I will end now. Somehow or other, this is a very rich culture. Came from India. It's because the world became a global village. This spread all over the world. In Oslo now, a simple place. In India, we have very large establishments, very, very big, many big temples. In many countries, actually, we have a large following. It was in Moscow, there were thousands of people just for a festival a few days ago. I was in Zagreb, there were hundreds of people. In Croatia, which is a smaller country. And regularly in a country like South Africa, where we also on big festival get hundreds and thousands of people, 500,000 people coming for our festivals. So a lot of people in the world are aware. Yeah, some air. Yes, a lot of people in the world are aware that there is a need for spiritual life. And if there's anyone who thinks, it's just a waste of time, then we can speak about it. So, if any of you would like to respond a little bit, it's our tradition that at the end of the talk we take 5 minutes for a little discussion. If anyone has a question or a comment, that would be nice.
Okay, you have that.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the coins if the coins were to buy firewood.
Oh, didn't I say that?
Yes,
thank you. Mm-hmm. In that story, yeah, I forgot the detail. Yes, people were throwing coins on that body so that they could buy firewood, so that they could burn the body. Yes, and slip up in the story. Thanks for catching me. Yes, he was not asleep.
Thank you, Maharaj, for coming to Norway. We hope that you will come again soon.
Well, Norway is it's a nice country. I came here many years ago, and several times, and so on. But yeah, I'm everywhere in so many countries and just so many people. And then I'm a lot in Africa these days. So therefore, Oslo is a little out of the way, I must admit. But it's very nice at the same time.
But at least you came once.
I came again. I came again now. After a long time. I didn't come once, I came.
It was so long time ago.
It still counts. Now, I came a long time ago, and I liked the people. You know? At that time, we had a big place, maybe a little overambitious, in Elsero or something.
Elsero.
And you guys don't do re, you do ro. Swedish do everything re, you do ro. That's ro. Yeah, and then people were very very enthusiastic at that time when I came here. I don't know what it was. 98. It was after 98. Maybe 2000, 99, something like that. And people were so enthusiastic. And I saw that people in Norway are, they appeared like people that are not so complicated, that are kind of people that live from the heart and relatively simple, not people with a big facade. Little shy, maybe. Yeah. Sorry. Shouldn't have said that.
No problem. No problem.
Yeah. So, you don't want to jam the computer. Okay. Anyway, so it's nice to be back, and I hope to find the time to be back in the future. Yeah, sorry for that.
We have an open invitation.
Okay. Thank you. Very nice. Okay, yes. Where are you from?
I'm from Bangladesh.
Bangladesh, to get us to.
Yeah. I just want to say that at the time